So according to Watson and Crick, the central dogma of biology is DNA tells RNA what to do, and then RNA tells the protein what to do. And protein is, of course, responsible for the actual function of the organism, the enzyme, the motor, and the muscle, and so on. And DNA is information storage, and to use the metaphor that we prefer these days, it's like the hard disk. And the RNA are like floppies that you can make as many copies as you like to give to your friends. You don't want to mess with your hard disk, but you can have as many copies of RNA as you like. So there are many forms of RNA, and but in the last few years, there has been a dramatic discovery that RNA has a catalytic role to play, and it acts as an enzyme. And since in biochemical reactions, most biochemical reactions just depend on the shape of these giant molecules, so the shape of RNA is important. And Tinoco, the distinguished biochemist from Berkeley, was here in the early part of the program, and he gave a talk. And in his paper, he said that scarcely 10 years ago, RNA was just a passive carrier of genetic information from DNA to the proteins, and now it's become a very important player in molecular biology. And in his paper specifically, there was an interesting paragraph in which he asked all the people that work on protein folding to stop working, to switch to RNA folding, which he's, so Hollande and I listened to this and decided to fold RNA. RNA has been folding proteins for many years, and so he switched, at least for the time being. I'm a theoretical physicist, so I know very little about biology, and what I know about RNA, or what I don't know about RNA, can all be found in this review paper by Hicks on RNA, who is also here in the audience. So again, for the physicists, a quick reminder, RNA is a heteropolymer. It's a sequence that's made out of a four-letter alphabet, C, G, A, and U. These things are called nucleotides, as I've learned. So a typical sequence would be C, 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 G, G, C, G, U, 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 A, U, and so on. And it ranges from 100 such nucleotides to 1,000. So this is a much smaller, much shorter molecule than DNA. There's an attraction between C and G, and also an attraction between A and U. So if the binding energy in some strange units of 3 and 2, and also a small attraction between G and U in this unit of 1. So the attraction between the C and G and between A and U, it causes, these attractions cause the chain to fold up into a three-dimensional structure. And it's important to realize that the chemistry responsible for the attraction is the force, the attraction between these bases are saturated. So this is a very crucial point. I mean, once a C is paired with a G, it does not pair with another G. And this is one of the features that makes RNA folding much, much easier problem than protein folding. Because in protein folding, the amino acids, which is plays the same role as the CGAU here, they interact by van der Waals and electrostatic forces, and so there's not this saturation property. Now, the energy scale involved is bigger than room temperature or the body temperature of biological organisms by a factor of 4 to 6. And so really only the one configuration, only the ground state configuration is relevant. So you know this because in your body the RNA shape, folded RNA is not constantly flipping back and forth between different shapes. So here's an example of a relatively short RNA sequence from yeast. And so here's the sequence G, A, C, A, C, and so on. And it folds up into this three-dimensional structure. This is from yeast. And so it's important. So to go from sequence space to shape space, the important problem is given the sequence, what kind of shape it would take it would assume. So in this field, there's a famous thing called the Vienna package, which you can find on this website. So if you go to this website, you can type in the sequence, and these people would fold it for you and tell you what the shape is. And this was written by this Viennese group. And Schuster was here earlier in the program, and Walter Fontana is right here, I think, somewhere in the audience. Yeah, he's right here. So, yes. Right, I'm going to come to that. Okay. Right, I'm going to come to the secondary and tertiary structure in a second. So a much more complicated piece of RNA, a ribosomal RNA, is given here. And you see that there are many, many more bases. It's a much, much longer thing. And there are various terms. This comes from E. coli. There are various terms, like this is called clover leaf, this is a hairpin. So let us focus, again for the physicists, let's focus on this particular fragment of the hairpin. So it looks something like this. And each one of these beads along here is one of these nucleotides and takes on value CGAU. And where they're paired and attracted to each other, it's paired like this. And then it goes around in what is called a hairpin. Okay, so the question for us is then, does a field theorist have anything to say about this? Okay, and this is the secondary structure that Professor Fisher just referred to. So if I take one of the segment of that of the previous diagram, so if I focus in on a small on one of these pieces, right? So it has a long chain of beads. And some of them are paired with each other. So I've labeled them. I've labeled the beads by numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, all the up to 28. And 3 is paired with 12, 4 with 11, 5 with 10, and so on. Now imagine pulling this apart. If I were to pull this apart, then the beads would lie on a line going from 1 to 28, and 3 is now paired with 12, and 4 with 11, and 5 with 10. And similarly here, 16 is paired with 26, and so on. So to field theorists, this immediately looks like, and this is what we'll make precise later, like Feynman diagrams, and in particular rainbow diagrams. And this looks like a fermion propagator. The black line can be thought of as a fermion interacting via some boson. So the fermions emits a boson, which is then reabsorbed. And this is the kind of thing that's very familiar to field theorists. Now, this is what is called a tertiary structure. But in RNA folding, there's also some weak, once this structure is formed like this, there would be some weaker interactions, for example, say between 15 and 9, or 2 and 6, or between these two hairpins. These two hairpins can attract each other. And these produce things called tertiary structures, pseudonauts, and so on. And so let's understand this from the Feynman diagram point of view. So a tertiary structure, so I've indicated here that imagine two connected to 6, and 9 connected to 19, 8 connected to 20. So then in this diagram, we would have 2 connected to 6, 8 connected to 20, and 9 to 19, right? So now this is no longer a set of rainbow diagrams. So in fact, the tertiary structure in RNA, they look like, at least they remind field theorists, of cross diagrams in which the lines of the bosons cross. Now, another feature that makes RNA folding problem much more attractive and much easier to solve than protein folding is because the tertiary structure can be considered as a small perturbation on the secondary structure. Now, the secondary structure in RNA folding has already been...
Why is that?
Sorry?
Why is it information on...
I think it's the details of the chemistry that I don't really understand.
Is there anything that forbids having part of the secondary structure involving the crossing?
What do you mean? If you like, this is the definition of secondary and tertiary structure. Okay? That's our definition. So the secondary structure has been studied in great detail by biophysicists, and in particular in the Vienna package that I mentioned earlier, that of which one of the authors here in the audience, the secondary structure is worked out in detail, and there are several other people in the audience that have worked extensively on the secondary structure of RNA folding. So what we would like to do, what Alain and I'd like to do, was to give a systematic way of treating the tertiary and the secondary structures. So this problem, to a field theorist, has a very clear topological flavor. So the diagrams, if we think about Feynman diagrams, then they're diagrams like this, in which the boson lines cross, and diagrams like this, in which they do not cross, and lines in which they do cross. So it's not, again, as we heard from yesterday's talk on networks, that word topology is abused in a little bit. But this appearance in topology in field theory is well known to field theorists, and it started with Tuhoff's work on quantum chromodynamics. And here I would switch gear and address the biologist rather than the physicist in the audience. So quantum chromodynamics is the theory of quarks and gluons. And as you probably know, the quarks carry a color. Quarks come in three different colors, so in the real world, quarks have three different colors. But what Tuhoff proposed to do is to let the number of colors be a variable called capital N. So N is the number of colors which he imagined tends to infinity. And he asked himself the question of what happens when N goes infinity. So quarks come in N colors. So we draw a Feynman diagram for the process in which a quark comes along and it emits a gluon. Feynman, quote unquote Feynman, would draw it like this. But what Tuhoff did is to introduce a different formalism, which is called the double line formalism. Because quarks carry colors, we can imagine a purple quark which goes into an orange quark by emitting a gluon, and this gluon would be half purple and half orange. Okay, so Tuhoff would draw a diagram like this, in which a purple quark comes in, a purple line comes in, and then an orange lines come out. So you see by comparing this that the gluons are described by double lines. The quarks are described by a single line, the gluons by this double line. Okay. So here's a gluon moving along. And as you can see, it carries two colors. So in the example, one color is purple, the other is orange. But since they're n different colors, they're n square different kinds of gluons. So the gluon field is really a matrix. It carries two indices, the field A. It carries an index I and index j. So this I goes index goes from 1 to n, and j carries goes from 1 to n. So in this example, I is purple and j is orange. Okay. So clearly, since each of these indices can take on n values, they're n squared different choices. So it can be thought of as a matrix. So this is an example of a matrix field theory. So let me explain to the biologist. Yes. No, the arrows, so as you know in Feynman diagrams, there are also arrows that indicate momentum flow. But what Tuhoff pointed out, as you like, is there's an additional flow of quantum numbers that you have to describe, which is, if you like, the flow of color. Okay, so there are two indices. One purple is flowing this way and orange, but momentum could be going this way or that way. Okay, so now let us consider a purple quark propagating along. So For example, Feynman, I would just call this fictitious Feynman. The fictitious Feynman would draw for example, a diagram like this that would describe a quark moving along. And then the next diagram would be a quark moving along and emitting a gluon which gets reabsorbed. This is a standard Feynman diagram. Now, in Terhoff's double line formalism, this would just be this, since we're looking at a purple quark. And this diagram would correspond to that. But now you have a box of n crayons to choose from to color this line. So this diagram gets a factor of n, right? It occurs, there are n different possibilities. So it's weighted by a factor of n. So to make sure that neither diagram dominates, so that these two diagrams are comparable, so that in the large n limit, one diagram doesn't dominate over the other, Terhoff proposed to say that each gluon propagator carries a factor of 1 over n. So this is a very important rule that I ask you to remember. So every time you see a double line, you should multiply by 1 over n. Okay? So now the next question that Terhoff asked himself was what happens to more involved diagrams. So let us look at two more involved diagrams. So again, on this side, I put down what Feynman would draw and what Terhoff would draw. So here are two Feynman diagrams, this one and this one. So for our purposes, there's a big difference between these two diagrams. One, the lines cross, and the other one, in this one, the dotted lines do not cross. Okay. Now, in Terhoff's double line formalism, we see it's represented like this. So as I told you, each time we see a double line, which is here and here, we should include a factor of 1 over n. So there's a factor of two factors of 1 over n here. But here, I have a choice of n colors. Right? The number of colors I can choose there is n. And here, the number of colors I can choose is n. So there's a factor of n times n. So therefore, this diagram is of order 1. Now, on the other hand, this diagram, if I draw it in the double line formalism, what Terhoff discovered is that you can draw it with just one color. If we're talking about a purple quark propagating, it's drawn completely in purple. So with this propagator and this propagator, for each of those propagators, we have 1 over n, 1 over n. But we no longer have a factor, this n squared, coming from color. So this diagram goes like 1 over n squared. So as n goes to infinity, when the number of colors becomes very large, this diagram is suppressed by a factor of 1 over n squared. So Terhoff's discovery is that the power of 1 over n squared counts the number of crossings in the Feynman diagram. Okay. So as I said in the beginning, in this talk, just like the other speakers in the program, I'm trying hard to address both biologists and physicists. So this is a very quick introduction for biologists to Terhoff's work on large N QCD. So at the risk of boring the physicists in the audience. Okay. So I'd like to also mention, so Terhoff shows that the power 1 of N squared actually counts the crossing. So in some sense, it tells you about the topology. And it turns out that there's a deep connection to Euler's theorem in topology. Okay. So now you would have noticed something interesting, which I think relates somewhat to Walter Fontana's remark of asking where the space-time and momentum comes in. So first of all, you realize that space-time was irrelevant in this counting. We never have to worry about what dimensional space-time we're in. So in particular, we can replace the 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time by 0 plus 0 dimensional space-time, if you like. Okay, you can have any dimension of space-time, this counting still works. And in fact, Terhoff, after he did this work, he went on to write a paper about this theory in 1 plus 1 dimensional space-time. The other thing you notice is that in real-life QCD, quantum chromodynamics, the theory of quarks and gluons, the gluons interact with each other. So for example, 3 gluons can interact by a diagram like this, or 4 gluons can interact by diagrams like this. But that is irrelevant also. It doesn't come into our counting. So as far as our topological counting is concerned, none of that is relevant. So this means that the counting that Tuhov proposed originally for quantum chromodynamics applies to random matrix theory. Now, random matrix theory was a subject that was started by Wigner in the early 50s. And basically, it amounts to the following. It amounts to calculating the partition function, doing the integral over n by n matrices, where n is large, of some weight, like e to the minus n trace 1/2 phi squared. So if you do this, you see the matrices, the matrix elements of phi are Gaussian random variables that you're integrating over. Now, the relationship to field theory is that if we put in an integral, if we make phi a function of x and t of space and time, and then I put in an integral over the integral over space and over time, then this would be a field theory in d plus one dimensional space-time. So you can think of matrix theory, random matrix theory, as a theory in 0 plus 0 dimensional space-time. So historically, there are all kinds of interesting things, which I, of course, cannot go into any details here, which is that random matrix theory, because of this connection to topology, it has to do with random surfaces. There's a connection to random surfaces. It counts the topology of the surface. And so random surfaces have to do with quantum gravity and to string theory, because as a string propagates in space and time, it sweeps out the surface. And this eventually led to the idea of M theory, where M stands for matrix. And this connection was pointed out in the early 1990s by Brezan, Kasakov, Gross and Migdal, and Douglas and Shenka, by three separate groups. Okay. So at this point, let us come back to our RNA problem. So this slide is a little bit technical, but this is the statement of the problem that we want to do. Okay? So as I explained earlier, you're given an RNA sequence, S1, S2, up to SL. So L, capital L, is the number of nucleotides in this particular sequence. And as I explained, typical value for L ranges from 100 to 1,000. So an example would be CG, CCG, AAA, UCG, and so on, up to U. Okay? So physicists want to calculate the partition function at some given temperature. So the partition function is given by Curly Z. It's equal to some integral, first of all, integrating over the three-dimensional position of each one of the nucleotides. So this is integrating over the position of the kth nucleotide. So there's, of course, integral over L variables. And then there's a function, and you can make different models. Two popular models is imagining the nucleotides, the A and U, are connected by some rigid rod. So this will be some delta function, or it could be some elastic rod in which it would be some Gaussian. So there's some function that constrains the position of L, given the position of LJ, what the position of LJ plus 1 is. Okay. So if you just have a polymer in which all the bases are equal, then this would be the problem that you want to do. But there's but we have a combinatorial problem here, which is how these different nucleotides actually attract each other. So there's another factor here, capital Z, which is the combinatorial heart of the problem. Okay? So let us first define a matrix Vij. So this is a matrix in which I and J runs from 1 to L, where L is the length of this sequence. Okay? So it's given by this formula. So this is, of course, Boltzmann factor. Beta is the inverse of the temperature, right? And then there's this epsilon SISJ. So SI is the identity of the thing. So this thing tells us whether, as I explained in the beginning, if you have a C that's attracted to a G, but if you have an A, it's attracted to a U. So epsilon is a 4x4 matrix whose many of its entries are zero. Okay? And V is some attractive potential, generically, like this. And then there is a theta function, which expresses the fact that this chain is not infinitely flexible. You cannot bend it around in any way you like. But there's a rigidity which tells you that if two bases are greater than 4 units apart, then you get zero. So this is what causes these hairpin structures that I showed earlier, right? So, for example, in this matrix Vij, suppose I is 2 and J is 7. Then they're far apart, so then the distance between them is greater than 4. Then we have V2, 7. So 7 is G. 2 is G and 7 is what, A or something. Then there's no attraction, but if the 7 was a C, then there would be an attraction and so on. So this encodes, this matrix V then encodes the sequence and position of nucleotides. Okay, so it's worth emphasizing that in this talk we're considering a specific sequence and not an ensemble of sequences. There have also been a lot of work on random RNA sequences and the ensemble property of such random sequences. Okay, so now I come back to this in the calculation partition function, you have to calculate this capital Z. So the capital Z is then 1 plus Vij, when we can write it down. It's all possible pairings between the nucleotides. So I write these things down so that I and this square, this bracket means IJKL are ordered in along this line. So this term and this term, this term corresponds to something like this. I connected to J and K we connected to L. While this corresponds to I connected to K and J connected to L. And so plus many, many terms, right? Plus all these terms. So now since room temperature, as I said before, biological temperature is much less than the melting temperature of RNA, which of course we all know since it does not melt in your body. So what we want is not so much to calculate the partition function. We don't want this capital Z, but we want to ask what is the dominant term in this series, right? In this of all these terms. We want to find the biggest term, right? So the dominant term will give you the ground state configuration. So that's the problem we want to do. Okay, so I hope that everyone understood what we're trying to do. So in this work with Orlan that we have done, we're not going to consider the integration over the position of the nucleotides, which one has to do numerically. But we're going to consider the combinatorial problem of picking out the largest term in this capital Z. So for that, we'll formulate it in terms of a matrix theory. But first, before I do that, now I have to switch again and address the biologist. So this is something the physicists know very well, which is that I would have to explain to biologists what Wick's theorem is that physicists all learned in school. So this is a theorem due to Giancarlo Wick, and biologists, as I heard in this program, know about Gaussian integrals. They use Gaussian integrals often. So if you do this Gaussian integral, x to the 6, this is the answer. There's some number here which turns out to be 5 times 3 times 1. Okay, so, the number is 15, but it can be written this way. Wick pointed out that you can calculate this number in the following way. X to the 6th power corresponds, you know, you can write the 6 powers out, so there's 6 x's. And then you connect all possible pairs. This is, physicists call this a Wick contraction, since it was invented by Wick. So as you can see, you can take the first x, and there are 5 possible x's you can connect it to. And that gives you a factor of 5. The second x, there are only 3 things you can connect to, and the last one is fixed. So this is how you get this factor, 5, 3, and 1. Okay? So Wick's starting observation is this integral can be interpreted in this way. Then you can immediately think of generalizing Wick's theorem, this Gaussian integral. If you have many different integration variables, if you have multiple integral, x1 through xl. And so in the exponential, in general, it would be a quadratic form, xi, xj. And if you have a matrix V, and if we have the inverse of the matrix here, the inverse ij, then if you were to do this integral, Wick's theorem generalizes. You form all possible Wick contractions, and everywhere you have a contraction like 1 and 2, you would write V12, and if you have a 1 X1 contracted XK, you would write V1K, 3 with L, you would write V3L, and so on. And so the statement is that this is a sum of all possible Wick contractions, terms like this. So that's the statement of the theorem. So now that I told you about this theorem, you see immediately what we're going to do, how we're going to calculate this object Z. This is a sum of 1 plus Vij of all possible contractions between the different Vs. So we're going to represent this object Z as an integral, as a Wick type integral. Okay? So is that clear to the biologists? Okay? So as I said before, we're going to focus, in this paper I've written with Olan, we focus on capital Z. We're not going to worry about the integration over R. Okay. So what Olan and I, what we studied is then, first we write down the matrix theory representation of capital Z. So I've written it out, and I'll now explain the different pieces. So first of all, so this is a function of M and N, defined into a function of two integers. Okay. First, there's some normalization factor. Don't care about that. Then we integrate over phis. Now, in the Wick's theorem, I just showed you we integrate over ordinary numbers, x. But Wick's theorem also applies if you integrate over matrices. So these phis are going to be matrices. And so there are going to be L of them, k from 1 to L, d phi k. There is some exponential, and this is exactly the same thing that we wrote down before. There's the inverse of some matrix, V inverse ij, trace of phi I phi j. And then there is a product, trace of a bunch of product of matrices from 1 plus phi n all the way to 1 plus phi m. And this is an ordered product. And phi I a b, as I said, are L matrices. Each one of them is n by n, and they live on a one-dimensional lattice. Okay? So to a particle physicist, A and B, the columns and rows are them numbers. N is this n by n matrix. These indices are color indices. And this index I would be a flavor index of some kind. That's what particle physicists would call it. A condensed matter physicist would call this the site index. Okay, and think of this as L matrices living on a one-dimensional lattice on a line. Okay? So this is a non-translation invariant Gaussian field theory, if you like, on a lattice. Right? But it's non-translation invariant because we have this matrix V inverse IJ. So the positions are fixed. And this order product, if I were to write it out, it would be obviously there's going to be 1. That's why we put in this 1 here. And then there's going to be phi I phi J in all possible combination. You pick out 2 possible phis here. Then there's a term with 4 phis. The one with odd number of phis obviously will integrate to 0 by symmetry. Okay? So once you have this written out, then you apply Wick's theorem. Then you see you get what you want. Right? So when you would contract, for example, in this term, you would contract I with J and K with L, and you get Vij, VKL. Okay. So it's worth emphasizing that this is for a specific RNA sequence. It's not for an ensemble of random sequences. Right? So once you have it formulated like this, then we can just look at this expression. Yes? Right. Right, so what we want to calculate, what we want is Z1L in the end, right? But MN is a subsequence, right? So you know where I'm going, which is to look at the recursion relation and so on. Yes? Right, so it's the particular sequence is encoded in this matrix Vij, right? Because, so let me remind you what Vij is. So Vij is given in terms of this, so it depends on the specific SISJ. The SIs and SJs are not random variables. They're given to you. So S2 is G and S1 is C, some specific sequence. Okay, is that clear? So once I guarantee the biologist that it's very simple. Once you understand Wick's theorem, which is basically Gaussian integrals, then this makes perfect sense. So then just you have this integral over matrices to do. So it's as I said, it's a Gaussian theory, but the observable, this is what physicists call the observable, is non-trivial. Okay? So then, but we learn also from this Terhoff's analysis that if I calculate something like this and expand it in power 1 over n squared, then the power 1 over n squared would count systematically how many crossings I have. Okay? So therefore, an expansion in powers of 1 over n would give us a systematic procedure of extracting the secondary structure, tertiary structure, etc., etc. So the point here is the emphasis is on systematic. Once you formulate in terms like this, then in principle, at least in practice, it may be very difficult to calculate this integral. But in practice, you can just expand and take n goes to infinity and keep all the terms or expand up to any power you like. Okay. So from this point on, it's a field theory problem, and I won't bore the biologists with the details, and which is going to be very, very technical. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Because any diagram, which is a planar diagram, would be in a
secondary structure.
Yeah.
Right.
Why, like any medium, that in terms of their definition, there would be some touching of the end.
Right.
I imagine that in that terms, there would be planar diagrams which would be tertiary.
Tertiary.
In the sense that you have the secondary diagram,
right.
And now you touch some things.
Yeah. Then you introduce crossings, right? In the way I explained. So this expansion then counts the number of crossings. The terminology of what is tertiary, and I'm not sure if that's in there. But let me, for the purpose of this talk, just count the number of crossings, because that's what Hollande and I have done. Okay, so if no further questions, I'll go on. So I'm not going to tell the audience how we calculated this beast here, which is really a big mess. But you already see what the trouble is, because what we want is we want to expand as a function of n. So we want to expand this thing as a so for the string theorists and for the people that worked on matrix theory, this is just a matrix integral, and people have done all kinds of complicated integrals like this. But what the difficulty, as you can see, if you wanted to expand in 1 over n, is that n is implicit in the size of the matrices. There's an explicit factor of n here, right? But n also appears in the size of the matrices. So we know when we do integrals, if there's an explicit n, then we can try to do steepest descent and expanding powers of n. But the size of these matrices are also changing with n. So that is the trouble. So what you want, the technical part of, is to try to make this dependence on n, the implicit n, to pull it out and make it explicit. So the trouble is the n is implicit in the size of the matrices, but few theorists have a whole bag of tricks that they can use to massage this expression. Okay. So a few weeks ago, I gave this talk on the East Coast to a field theory audience, and then the bulk of the talk is to talk about how we massage that expression. But since here there's such a mixed audience, I'm not going to describe the technical detail, but I'll just read the different steps of the different steps that we use. Okay. So the field theorists and the theoretical physicists in the audience would know what we do. So the first is products can be represented inverse of an operator. And then the inverse can be written as an integral over fermions, fermionic variables. And now when you integrate out the field phi, which is like a bosonic field, you get an interacting four fermion theory. And then you can see it's transformed to write things in terms of so-called color singlets. And then finally you introduce another matrix field A to couple to the color singlets. And in condensed matter physics, this is called the Hubbard-Stratonovich transformation. And in particle physics, it has no name. It's just some well-known transformation. So after you follow all these steps, which is quite a bit of work, you end up with some expression like this, where M is now an L plus 1 by L plus 1 matrix. And now N is completely gone. In its own, the dependence on N is explicit. It's this determinant raised to the nth power. And this square bracket means that you do the integral over A, over matrix A with this weight. So N appears in the exponential and appears in this power. And now N is explicit and you can do the large N expansion. Yeah. So A is just an integral to, A is an integration variable. It's a matrix that you're integrating over.
But that's not N dependent.
A is not N independent, right? A is also L by, L plus 1 by L plus 1. Actually, it's L by L. So it's, the N dependence is now completely explicit. That's what we managed to do.
Where are your original interactions, the VIJs?
The VIJs are buried in A. Yeah, that's a good question. So the VIJs are now buried in, they appear in A in some concrete way. So it's a mess. Okay, but this is the kind of expression that field theorists can actually do something about because the N is now explicit and you, for example, can do steepest descent.
But you're integrating over A.
Right.
So A is not a specific.
No. In this M of A, this V appears, right? So that's what where does the V dependence comes in?
Right. Okay. So A is an L by L variable, M is a dependent function.
Right.
And now H, would you think
of some? H is a parameter. So let me, since I'll ask the biologist to be patient for a second, and if I brought the transparencies that shows what A is, since there are all these questions about this M of A, let me just show the matrix explicitly for the condensed matter theorists here and the string theorists here. This is the matrix M, okay? And it's L plus 1 by L plus 1, and the this parameter H appears up here, and the A's and B's, don't worry about the B's, the A's are here, and the A's are then related to capital A by this. That's the formula for M of A. Okay? So again, for Matt, this is the fermion determinant. Yeah, okay, I don't know if the biologists know what a fermion determinant is, but for the field theorists, this is something that occurs quite often. Okay, so let me see, where am I? So now I'm all confused, because this was one of the transparencies I was not supposed to show. Yes, so here, we've beaten it down to this expression in which the N dependence is implicit, but now then after applying all those field theoretic tricks that if you go to a good graduate school and paid tuition you would learn all these tricks and you beat it down to an expression like this. Okay, now with this expression then we can do two different things. Okay, there are two different paths we can follow. One is we can do steepest descent, right? So with an integral, steepest descent, let n go to infinity and expand. It turns out the 1 over n zero terms are easy, and they reproduce a secondary structure. But the 1 over n square term are quite difficult. They actually gives a set of equations that looks like Beta-Salpeter equations. And people again, the particle physicists would know what I'm talking about here, and the condensed matter physicists. This Beta-Salpeter equation also occurs in condensed matter. The other approach that we can follow is to do recursion. So recursion means you change L. So L is the length of the RNA chain. So now you say, suppose you go from L to L plus 1. So physically, this corresponds to adding or removing a nucleotide at the end of the chain. So this kind of thing is well known in statistical physics, and it's vaguely inspired by the renormalization group idea. So we have an L by L matrix, remember. So what this means is that you take an L plus 1 by L plus 1 matrix and relate it to the property of an L by L matrix. And this is also a trick that's used in random matrix theory quite often. An example is this paper in this French journal. They now allow papers in English, so one can now actually publish in this journal. I think this was one of the first issues that allowed, in 1993, I think the French decided they would allow papers in English. So my collaborator thought that we should publish a paper in there now that they allow English. Before that, he said he refused to publish in this journal because they will only allow French. So so this corresponds to, in random matrix theory, integrating out a row and a column. So I don't have time to, so this is quite technical, and we have written a paper, and the details are in our paper. So these two approaches, I'm only going to mention very quickly the recursion approach. Now, so what we want is to extract the 1 over n squared term in succeeding powers of 1 over n squared. So I only talk about recursion. Well, the 1 over n zero term, the leading term, is already well known. Those correspond to the diagrams that do not, with no crossing, those are the secondary structures. And this goes back, there's a long list of people that have worked on this. Some of them are in this room. So it started, I guess, with Nusanov and Jacobson. And in the community I came from, Nusanov is a well-known name, but I was told by my collaborator that this is a different Nusanov, it's his wife. So most of the particle physicists in this audience probably think of the other Nusanov. Zucker, and I already mentioned this Vienna group, Walter Fontana, who's in the audience, and various people. And then more recently, as you can see, within the last year, there are papers by Bunshaw and Hua, Lubensky and Nelson, and Mazar and collaborators. So the 1 over n zero term are well known. So what we have obtained is really the correction to this 1 over n n zero term. So what we obtain is a recursion relation like this. And so if we omit this, that's what the previous authors have obtained. So we obtain something like this. And again, this is perhaps too technical for the biologists, so I will not go through it in detail. But this is the kind of thing that's familiar to to field theorists. It goes under the name of Dyson-Schwinger. You pick out the one particle irreducible subset of graphs in some graphs. These are the graphs that do not fall apart when they don't break into two. So a Feynman diagram like this is called one particle irreducible. And this is called not one particle irreducible, because if you cut here, it would fall into two pieces. Okay, so that's the technical term. And so this vertex function is explicitly order 1 over n squared. So that's the correction term that we calculated. But I won't go through this in detail. But I just wanted you to look at the structure, which is a recursion relation. It tells you that if you know Zik and all these quantities for a smaller problem, you can go to a bigger problem, Zik plus 1. So it's a recursion relation. And these recursion relations, biophysicists use there's a standard backtracking algorithm to deal with this. So, so the procedure would be, that we imagine would be something like this. Given an RNA sequence, we'll S1 through SL, we'll construct this matrix Vij, and then we'll iterate the equation that I showed in the previous transparencies to obtain the ZMN, and then the Z1L. Now, in the end, we do not want Z1L as such, but the most dominant term in Z1L, Z1L is a sum of many, many terms, but we only want the ground state configuration. We don't want the full partition function. So to extract the dominant term, The algorithm that people use is this backward propagation of backtracking. So it's easy to understand. Z1L is given by recursion relation as Z1L minus 1 plus a sum of terms. So you pick the largest term on the right-hand side, and you say Z1L is approximately equal to that on the right-hand side, okay? So if it's Z1, the largest term in this sum, and if the largest term is Z1L minus 1, then we repeat the procedure. If the largest term is one of the other terms, then, but it's constructed out of the ZMNs, so then you repeat the same procedure, and you just keep repeating this, and this is called backtracking algorithm. And I think that's widely used. And so then you end up with Z1L as a sum of terms, and this is supposed to be exact as the temperature goes to zero. So to summarize, we have given an elegant, if I may say so myself, an elegant representation of the RNA folding problem in terms of large N matrix theory. And we succeeded in writing the theory with N explicit. So it was not, it was easy to write it in terms of a large N matrix theory, but the hard part was to make the N dependence explicit so one can do steepest descent. And we derived the recursion equation for relating L plus 1 to L. And this gives a systematic algorithm for determining the ground state configuration. Now, I'd like to close with an amusing footnote that may appeal to some of you. As some of you know, a classic problem in combinatorial optimization is the bipartite matching problem, which is also known as the marriage problem. Okay, so this problem was originally studied by this guy Knuth, whom I was told is famous for inventing tech or something. But since I don't use tech, I don't know. And it's this book has been, there's a book devoted to the marriage problem called the stable marriage problem. And then it has been worked out, and I first learned about it from Orlan when he visited here about 8 or 9 years ago. One day Orlan came into my office and asked me if I know anything about the marriage problem. And I said no. And here is some recent paper. Okay. So the marriage problem is given EIJ, suppose you're given a set of men, men sub I and women sub J, then if you connect, if MI and WJ are matched together in a marriage, let EIJ be the energy cost, which is the minus of the happiness of the marriage. Okay, so if let L be an even integer and consider L individuals, so a given matching, for example, if I married Mr. 1 to Mrs. 4, you know, marry 1 to 4, 3 to 8, and L minus 1 to 2, this will be the total energy cost of that particular match. So the problem, I think, originally proposed by Knuth, I guess, is to find a match that would minimize E. Right? So that's to find a match that is the best possible match. But we see that we can immediately get a representation of this from our problem. By taking a suitable limit immediately. It's very easy. I have this line of L sites, right, in the RNA folding problem. I now make them, all the men stand on the odd sites and all the women stand on the even sites. Okay? And then I have this Vij, and the Vij is e to the minus beta Eij. This is precisely the thing we want to minimize. So where beta is the inverse temperature, and at the end we'll let the temperature go to zero. And that would pick out the ground state. So the ground state is the optimal match that minimizes total energy. And then you have a factor like this in front, so which tells you that if I plus J is, there can be a match only if I plus J is odd. So because the men are standing on odd sides and the women on the even side, so you make sure that men are only matched to women. So, but then we, since in this problem we allow crossing, we don't have to take the Tuhov large N limit. We just let N goes to 1. So all we do is to take our formula, let n goes to 1, and we get a representation of the marriage problem. So there's some connection between these two problems. Okay, thank you. Yes? No. N is a parameter, is a mathematical artificial parameter used to control the number of crossings. So you imagine that n is a free parameter where n is very, very large, and you make an expansion in powers of 1 over n. And the powers of 1 over n counts for you how many crossings there are. So in the end, there's no n. N is to be 1 in the end. There is no such thing as n. The fact that you have four letters in the alphabet, that's just the statement that the matrix epsilon is 4 by 4. Okay. Sorry? Yes? No, it's a mathematical trick to count Feynman diagrams for you, to count, classify Feynman diagrams of different topological classes. Yes?
I definitely don't want to go on the side of things. It seems to me that the only problem you're solving is the one in which you maximize the number of base pairs. Mm-hmm. Not quite the one in which you minimize the energy of the configuration. The reason being the following.
Mm-hmm.
Your energy matrix, when you say that DC is minus 3 kilocalories per mole, speaking, that doesn't make sense, because what is minus 3 kilocalories per mole is a static.
Right.
And a DC radiation for another DC.
Right.
It becomes. Energy unit that makes up a secondary structure onto the loops.
Right.
Where you have a certain number of, if you have one pair and a certain number of unpaired bases in a pair
right.
loop, if you have
right.
zero unpaired bases in two pairs,
right.
you have a stack.
Right.
So it seems to me that the procedure that you are developing here is one suited for maximizing the number of base pairs.
Right.
Slightly different properties.
Right, right.
And since you then weight them by saying
right.
DC values minus 3
right.
and AU values minus 2.
Right.
You're sort of biasing
what
type of
pair. Right. Well, fortunately, not only do I understand the question, I even know the answer to the question. So, which is this stacking energy. So, this is one of the things I learned in this program, that the stacking energies are important. So, here, I should have said for simplicity, we just may consider pairs between nucleotides. But suppose you want to include stacking energy. So, for example, I don't know the details of stacking energy, but a CG pair wants to be followed by a CG pair, and so on. And I guess this comes up a lot in Trifonov's talk about the different probability of different pairs following each other, and so on and so forth. But there is for amino acids or something. But, so then, instead of considering each nucleotide as one unit, we can consider two subsequent nucleotides as a pair, right? So we can have CC, CG, GC, GG. And so that just makes our epsilon matrix, instead of 4 by 4, into a 16 by 16 matrix. So that's one way of taking care of the stacking energy, but the formalism would be the same.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Right.
So there's a whole host of loop energies depending
right. on the size of the loop, the nature. Right. But some of that comes from the integral over R, right?
No.
Oh, but the formalism, I conceptually. And the formalism is still the same, right? I just make the 4 by 4 matrix into a bigger matrix, into a 16 by 16 matrix, and I can incorporate some of these things.
So are you saying you're talking about energy cost from the rigidity of the structure as it goes around?
No.
All I'm saying is that
what do you mean by loop? I'm just not far in general.
There's one way of holding an RNA sequence by which you just maximize the content. Therefore,
right.
The unity count is really a base pair. That's his case. But then, if you think in actual RNA sequence structures, the value of the unit depends on its context. You know, whether it is adjacent to another pair, base pair, then it's a stack, and it's a stack that is being weighted.
That part
is not adjacent to another base pair, but separated from it a little bit, and it's a loop. Depending
on how far
you separate them in the ladder, people have different energy values. So the units that matter then become little loops and graphs rather than
Luca?
That's one of my suggestions, that the magnetic program is very underway, and the lasting program.
We haven't thought about that. But N is just an artificial parameter that we used. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Wow.
Terry?
The polynomiality of the problem has to do with even things like that polynomial in two dimensions. And it might be that the theory is the same, it's a low dimensional system, and this might be polynomial. In fact, this is related with what I wanted to ask.
Yes.
And it's related with Trifonov's work.
Uh-huh.
In fact, I do think that the claim is that diagrams with a topology which cannot be brought to a planar, which imply kind of knots in the structure, would be disallowed because, in fact, they never appear in real proteins.
In proteins, okay. Okay. Well, I don't know about proteins, so I. That's, yeah, Terry.
Expansion in powers of n, because n is counting the number of crossings, whereas the application of this is in pseudonyms.
Right, right.
Pseudonyms, and you can usually have pseudonyms that have the two in a row, but several in a row is counting n.
And it would be counted as the same level, is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
They should really, the energy would really be coming as the same.
Right, right.
Even though the n equal to zero, the no pseudonym one is much lower energy than the other one.
Okay.
The other n is
Yeah. Okay. My understanding of these structure is very limited. I thought it has to be related to the number of crossings.
So along this line, there was a work of a Shanghai and collaborator which had sort of this kind of a self-consistent diagram at the next level.
Whose work?
This work by Shanghai and Riva and Eddie.
Is that true?
It wasn't complete. They have all kinds of things.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Instead of discussing little details of energies,
right.
Could you describe what is ground state in your understanding, in your scheme?
Well, in this simplified version, without including stacking energy and so on, the ground state would just be the term in this capital Z is given in terms of a sequence of many terms. It's the term with the highest value. It's the term that is the biggest.
Maximal gross interval?
No, no. It would be the term with the lowest
plus
energy.
Number of base pairs.
Right. Yeah, the lowest energy.
I got a bit confused at the end. You write down this recursion relating V of L,
right.
V of L minus 1.
Right.
Now, this seems very natural at the level of these rainbow diagrams,
right.
Because then it's a sum of actually product terms,
right.
And
right.
Sort of time intervals factorized.
Right.
Now, if you take crossing diagrams, these one particular used one, then that factorization property seems lost. So can you still write down such a simple recursion relation?
Well, this is why our recursion relation is not very simple. Again, this is perhaps one of the slides that I did not show would answer some of these questions. What we would like to do is to evaluate by steepest descent that once we got that expression that I showed you, right? And then we were hoping that the recursion relation would just pop out. But what happens is actually something like this, that when we did the calculation, the Z1L plus 1 is equal to Z1 of L times the expectation value of some combination of matrices, where this matrix M appears, but the details I haven't explained to you, is the inverse of this matrix. And we know very well from statistical mechanics, but because I'm a particle physicist, I refer to large N QCD, that when you have two color singlet operators, then the average of A and B factorizes. There's the leading term factorizes, and then the nonlinear term, which is linked, is down by order 1 of N squared. So, So we're after those terms. So if we just approximate this expectation value by this first term, we get the standard backward, the standard recursion relation that Bunshaw and Hua talked about in this program, for example. But it's these extra terms that we struggle to calculate, and that's what we have a lot of trouble calculating explicitly, perhaps because they're linked. Now, I don't know if this answers your question, but it's precisely this kind of linkage that makes it difficult to. You have to calculate the expectation value of some sub-leading operator.
The question is, calculate actually, you're not just taking a single ground state, but calculate the number of
different
situations that have zero crossings, one crossing.
Right, right. You can count by setting, I guess, the V's to one or something. Right. We haven't really thought about it. The standard backtracking for the secondary structure scales like L cube. I guess that's what Orlando and I was.
How many different structures are there that have
one crossing, two crossing? That's an interesting question, which we haven't. Yeah, you write, you know, by setting V equal to one or something, we can count the crossings.